car. That's 1-855-573-8227. And your car doesn't always have to be running either, but it does have to have an engine and be towable. And you must be the legal title holder. There's no cost to you, and you help out the station you enjoy with your vehicle donation. Again, to donate your vehicle to KPFT, call 1-855-KPFT-CAR. That's 1-855-573-8227. Thanks for your support. This is KPFT Houston.
You are listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Could you drag that on any longer? All right. Let me see. I got to get these headphones turned up, make sure that I can hear myself and other people can hear me, because that's important. Welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groovehouse.
Apparently, Lee is...
We don't know this yet. We don't know if he's been shot by John McAfee.
He's having a playing phone tag with John McAfee. Mostly he's it.
The Hunted.
So, yeah, so he's, I don't know what's going on, but Lee indicated that he was trying to get out the door, but
speaking to
John
our,
McAfee
our
kept
future
calling
president.
Him. Yes, our future president, all hail.
Most of it not fit for radio for some reason.
Apparently
I wanted to get him on air, but apparently that might not have been a great idea.
Barrett's always Who knows? Without thinking.
We've only got 8 seconds of dump.
That was a consensus.
He said dump. Man, this weather is just making me tired.
It got cold. I didn't expect that.
It's not cold.
It's chilly.
I thought
summer.
It was going to be in the 70s, and it's not.
No? Okay.
Or at least it didn't feel like it.
usually thunderstorms put me right. I mean, I sleep hard through thunderstorms, but last night, whatever was going on actually woke me up. It was amazing how loud the thunder was.
I didn't hear it.
I mean, I'd gotten down where you were, but on my side of town, it was impressive. I mean, the whole house was rattling. It was coming down. I mean, the thunder felt like it was actually just falling out of the sky. But I slept pretty good.
So you're saying you were thunderstruck?
I was thunderstruck, literally. Good one, Pete. Thanks for that, Pete. All right, so you can visit us online at geekradio.com. That's our website. You can also hang out with us on IRC, irc.cuckoo.com, in the channel Tech Bytes. If you have your own IRC client, you can just connect to the server and come in the channel. If you don't know much about IRC, but you're curious and you want to experiment, you can go to geekradio.com and use our IRC client, which will log you in automatically. And we have that going for us. So we had a good geek gathering this past Friday. It was quieter. Barrett wasn't there. KD5 wasn't there. But we had a nice group. And I fear we're not going to have one of those frozen geek gatherings like I like, you know, to have at least once a year.
I think winter's over. I think we have a summer full of insect-ridden geek gatherings.
No, they're not insect-ridden. Don't say that.
They have not been. But these are, you know, we're going to have to build robot insect combatants.
Back to the really gross geek gatherings with the foul odors and the bugs.
We have a Zika,
come on,
Zika gathering.
Zika gathering. That's right. The Zeke rhymes with Geeka, the Geeka gathering. All right, so yeah, so we did it. We had a good geek gathering. We were happy with that. So you need to come out to one. Hear me? Yes. So Barrett's back. Barrett was gone. Barrett was out of town. Barrett's back.
I have returned.
No Barrett time, though, I'm sure. But I want to ask at the top of the hour. That could change. Probably not. All right, so anyway, God, it's already almost, it's already, what, mid-March? Almost, you know, close enough to mid-March.
It's South by Southwest time, almost.
It's St. Patrick's time. What is all the
I
fuzz?
I think it's coming from inside the house. It's not. That's not of our headphones. Oh, that's in the spirit of professionality.
The crackle?
It's probably
crackle. Release the crackle!
Someone's mic, or it maybe whoever's... No one move. Pete, you move.
I'm not making...
It's hard to...
I've heard some, like, static bursts
There's
in the...
There's probably something living in the control board.
Yeah. It could be electrical interference, too, with all the electrical storms.
Hackers. It's hackers.
It's probably hackers.
We have been...
Hacker line one, actually.
We've been tracer
your call, hacker.
Yeah.
Some next generation stuff.
We probably need to reboot the station and the transmitter, just everything, to shut it all off.
Can someone climb up to the top of the tower and see if it's lightning outside, please?
Does this rag smell of chloroform? So, all right, so... I don't know what else to do. I miss Lee. I wish he was here. He's let us down for the... Well, not the last time, obviously.
17th. Well, it's 17th time.
The umpteenth time. Yeah. All right. So I guess what we'll do is we're going to do... I guess we can do the open mic version of the Technology Bytes Info Shot.
Sure.
Info Slam. Yeah. So we will let Pete take us through the paces of the Info Shot, and we'll... I'll chime in with our clever asides and observations. So take it away, InfoShot.
It's the Technology Bytes InfoShot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
So internet connections keep getting faster, you know, but websites are getting more complex. And it means that you still have to wait a long time for pages to load. This one's kind of cool. A new technique from MIT helps browsers gather files more efficiently, and that could change the kind of wait time that you're experiencing. Quote, as pages increase in complexity, they often require multiple trips that create delays that really add up, according to Ravi Netravalli, I guess, one of the researchers, in a press release. Quote, our approach minimizes the number of round trips so that we can substantially speed up a page's load time. The new system is known as Polaris. Has been developed by the university, by MIT's University of Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. The deal is, you know, loading a web page is an oddly complex business. When you hit enter after a URL or you click on a link, your browser busies itself gathering a series of objects, you know, HTML files, JavaScript, pictures, and anything else it needs. Each object is evaluated, then added to the page you're looking at. But that evaluation can result in having to fetch other dependent objects, you know, like, for instance, you know, like background images that are called from your CSS files, or that the JavaScript got or whatever. And browsers don't know what those dependencies are until they grab the object that calls them. If they did, they'd be able to pull across more files at one time, reducing the amount of back and forth across the network, reducing the time it takes to load a page. And that's where Polaris comes in. Apparently, what it does is log all the dependencies and interdependencies on a web page. It compiles all of these into a graph for that page that a browser can use to download page elements more efficiently. The researchers liken it to the work of a traveling salesperson. There's a metaphor for you. When you visit one city, you sometimes discover more cities you have to visit before going home. If someone gave you the entire list of cities ahead of time, you could plan the fastest possible route. Without the list, though, you have to discover new cities as you go, which results in unnecessary zigzagging between faraway cities. For a web browser, loading all the page objects is like visiting all of the cities. Polaris effectively gives you a list of all the cities before your trip actually begins. They tested this system on 200 different websites, including ESPN, weather.com, and Wikipedia. On average, it was able to load web pages 34% faster than a standard browser. They're going to present their work later this week at the USENIX Symposium on Network Systems Design and Implementation. The good news is that Polaris is written in JavaScript, which means it could be introduced to any website. It'd just have to be running on the server in question, so it would automatically kick in for any page load and used with unmodified browsers. But the long-term hope of the researchers is that it becomes integrated into the browsers we all use, where it could, quote, enable additional optimizations that can further accelerate page loads. And I'm sure we have to wait till it happens, just like we have to wait for the web pages to load right now. So I'm sort of surprised that browser companies like Google and such haven't already tried to do something like this, but apparently not. Apparently they were waiting for MIT to tell them.
Thank you, MIT, for finally fixing it for the rest of us.
I'm disappointed they threw in that extra 0.6%. They could have so easily had a 3.33333. Repeat, of course, improvement, and they missed it.
So it could be kind of infinitely improving because it'd just be
never ending improvement is what you pitch that as. Yeah,
yeah. So I guess it kind of makes sense. You kind of wonder what's going to happen when you look farther ahead. You know, like say 10 or 15 years from now. You know, web pages, they keep getting more complex and they keep having, you know, there's more things that it does and that the code that builds them does. And, you know, it starts turning into where it's practically a program on its own, let alone, I mean, you know, backing up a layer when it's something that's generated by, you know, Java or PHP or something on the server. There's the thing that gets into the browser is looking more and more like an application with animations and JavaScript and all that other kind of stuff. You almost wonder, is the day going to come where a web page is really like an app that just you download the app to your browser and the browser just plays the app in a particular way so you can see it? Anyway, so there's that. And then now into the more hackery end of the pool. Remember all those IRS, all the times where there was those identity hacks, there were a couple times where that came up and where a large number of people's stuff got nicked, as they say in England. The IRS has shut down the identity security tool for taxpayers due to those security problems. The identity protection PIN tool didn't offer enough security to bar fraudulent resets. So that at least temporarily, they put out a notice today, that said they were temporarily suspending the identity protection PIN tool as, quote, part of its ongoing security review. The IP PIN is supposed to act as an extra layer of security for taxpayers who are at higher risk of becoming the victims of fraud because of personal information leaked in commercial data breaches. So in other words, it's the sad part is the tool that's supposed to help you because you got your identity stolen is a tool that can be used to steal your identity. So last year, the IRS shut down an electronic tool for obtaining tax data after a massive fraud operation using stolen Social Security numbers and other data from commercial data breaches managed to extract filing data for hundreds of thousands of taxpayers. This year, the IRS is facing a new wave of fraud as criminals engage in a phishing campaign to get employees' W-2 form data. On March 1st, the IRS issued a warning to human resources departments throughout the U.S. about the wave of phishing attacks, which are emails purportedly from company CEOs directed to payroll or HR employees, usually with such texts as, "Kindly send me the individual 2015 W-2 PDF and earnings summaries of all W-2s of our company staff for a quick review." Or, "Can you send me the updated list of employees with full details, name, social security number, date of birth, home address, salary?" So obviously they knew what to ask for, but several companies have already reported they've been the victims of these attacks because employees fell for the messages. The exposures have placed thousands of current and former U.S. employees at these companies at risk for potential tax fraud. So, this PIN is usually distributed by mail, but the online IP PIN tool was put in place to help people who had misplaced or forgotten the 6-digit PIN that was issued to them. And for some taxpayers, those whose letter was lost, taxpayers that the IRS, quote, invited to get IP PINs because of non-tax identity theft issues, and taxpayers in Florida, Georgia, and the District of Columbia participating in a pilot program, the online tool was the only way to get that PIN. So there was a recent attack on the IRS.gov website that resulted in the breach of an IRS contractor's system, exposing 101,000 taxpayer social security numbers and other data, which prompted the security review and then led them to shut down the IP PIN thing. Taxpayers that have lost their IP PIN will now have to phone the IRS and verify their identity in order to get a new PIN mailed to them. Those that already have an IP PIN should include it on their tax returns. So there's a treat for you. Just another thing to make doing your taxes a little bit less fun than they already maybe were.
It's hard to take the joy away from that, really.
Well, making you have to call the IRS is probably about the best/worst thing they can do because they are understaffed. And there's been the whole thing where it says they're so short on staff that there's only some percentage of the calls that they're even able to answer. So there's that. But now you can feel better because on Tuesday, The Guardian reported that the FBI has changed its rules regarding how it redacts Americans' information when it takes international communications from the National Security, the NSA, National Security Agency's NSA database. The paper confirmed the classified rule change with unnamed U.S. officials, but here's the odd part. Since it's secret and it's from the secret court, there aren't a lot of details. So they know the rules changed. They know they changed to protect people's identities better, but you can't be sure what the whole change was. The new rules, which were approved by the secret U.S. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, FISC, F-I-S-C, deal with how the FBI handles information it gleans from the NSA. Although the NSA is technically tasked with surveillance of communications involving foreigners, information on U.S. citizens is inevitably sucked up too. The FBI is then allowed to search through that data without any, quote, minimization from the NSA. And minimization for them means redacting Americans' identifiable information unless there's a warrant to justify surveillance on that person. So without minimization means they got the raw data and could see everything. So the FBI enjoys privileged access to this information trove that includes emails, texts, and phone call metadata that are sent or received internationally. Recently, the Obama administration said it was working on new rules to allow other agencies similar access to the NSA's database. But, and here's the good news part of this whole story, The Guardian notes that the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Group, which was organized by the Obama administration in the wake of the Edward Snowden leaks, took issue with how the FBI accessed and stored NSA data in 2014. As of 2014, the FBI was not even required to make note of when it searched the data, which includes the to or from lines of an email, the Guardian wrote, nor does it record how many of its data searches involved Americans identifying details. So that's nice. However, a recent report from PC Lob, which is a private civil liberties oversight group, suggested that the new rules approved by FISC for the FBI include a revision of the FBI's minimization procedures. Spokespeople from the FBI and the PC Lob declined to comment on the apparent procedure change, saying it was classified, but their spokesperson told The Guardian that the new rules, quote, do apply additional limits. A spokesman for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence said the new procedures may be publicly released at some point. So congratulations, you have maybe sort of more privacy, but it's secret. So when Barrett called people from when he was out of the country, then that would be in the database. Mm-hmm. So there's a treat, but at least there's some, you know, the sad part is this is like progress, because before there was sort of nothing. It was like, oh yeah, you want the data here. And now apparently there's some secret limits. And now a totally now different tack, you know, Apple next week is going to have their, I think has their event thing where many rumors will be turned into either truth or, found out to be yet another fantasy. But Google is kind of trying to get the jump on them. So today they launched the next generation of its Android software, which powers more than 80% of the world's smartphones and tablets. The thing is, on this release, though, so before you get too excited, the software release, though, is an unfinished version specifically meant for software developers to mess around with. For now, the new version is only called Android N. Google routinely names its new Android software in alphabetical order and after suites. The latest version is called Marshmallow. Before that was Lollipop, so you kind of know how that works. I wonder what would N be? What's an N candy? Nesquik? No, that wouldn't work. That's not generic.
Nestle's. that's brand name, though.
So maybe that's why they're only calling it Android N. Some of the new features include split-screen views for running multiple apps and the ability to reply directly when you receive notifications. Apparently, you can actually already do that on Android Wear, which is Google's software that's tailor-made for wearable devices like smartwatches, and on some Google apps like Gmail. With the new release, the company has waged the latest strike in the smartphone war. Specifically in its site are Apple and the iOS software for iPhones and iPads. The companies have sparred for years trying to one-up each other with new features for their mobile software, and now it seems like one of the things is to make sure that they can do the same thing as the other guy, you know, whatever new feature the other guy puts in to match that up. That's the whole kind of split screen feature, which originally showed up on the iPad Pro, and the direct replies to notifications is something that iOS also already does. So this is early. Usually they announce new software during the annual I/O conference in May. The point of the earlier release is to get the software into developers' hands as soon as possible and get their feedback on how to improve it. The big challenge for Google, though, unfortunately, is getting people to use the latest version of their software. On Tuesday, Google said only 2% of Android devices are running Android 6.0 Marshmallow, which is the most current version of the software. The most popular version now on 36% of Android devices is Lollipop, which, just for reference, was released in November 2014. However, it took until this week for Lollipop to take the crown from Android 4.4 KitKat, which was released in October 2013. So they know, Google knows that this is a problem. I don't know that they have a solution, but and that may be part of why they're trying to release this sooner. Other promised tweaks include improved battery efficiency with Doze, which saves power when the device is stationary. Under Android N, Doze will offer additional battery savings when the device's screen shuts off. Google also said the new version of its operating system will offer better support for Oracle's Java 8 programming language, which should make programming more efficient so developers don't have to waste time on busy work, according to Google. I didn't realize that you needed to be a Java programmer to make Google stuff work. I guess maybe it's an add-on, or you know, I didn't think that Google's apps were, that any of their stuff was written in Java, but apparently I was wrong.
On the dessert front, the Wikipedia list of American desserts, no entry for N. There are no generic desserts starting with N. The best we can get is Greece calls nougat a dessert. I don't know if that's like what's in our candy bars or if that's a different creation, but yeah, Wikipedia says no.
Nougat or Newton's?
I like Ted Nougat.
Newton's, maybe?
Yeah,
baby.
But that's another brand, and that's a cookie at its base. They've been kind of going...
Kit Kat for K.
They did branding, though, because remember they actually had the Kit Kat logo and it spun around, so...
Yeah.
Oh. So maybe they're still trying to get Nestle Crunch to get them, to let them use the logo. And so in the final news story, this one, this is from Wired, and... The thing that they're saying is, and since I know that we have users, big users of Flickr, the headline is "Time to Give Up on Flickr, Everybody."
Oh no!
Yeah, it says once upon a time there was nothing like Flickr. If you were a person who cared about taking, editing, and sharing photos, it was the best and most robust community of like-minded people on the internet. Now he says now that's not true for the photo nerd crowd. 500 pixels px. And Smug Mug are just two of the many ways you can talk about photos in a deep, constructive way. Instagram, he mentions. It's the place for photos the way Flickr was once the place for photos. Even as it updated its search and organizational tools, Google Photos came along and one-upped its every feature. So Flickr rebranded a bit. You know, they did offer, he kind of goes through the history. Just shy of a year ago, Flickr started offering 1,000 gigs of free storage to every user, along with an automatic uploader tool that would help you take every photo from your computer and dump them in one place. Flickr's search engine was good, but then, I guess the thing that set them off this morning, Flickr announced that once again, its best tools will only be available to paying users. So he says it's time to call it that Flickr is dead over kaput. In the search for a few more people willing to fork over $35 a year to fund more purple offices, Yahoo has killed its photo service. Today's announcements really only include one change of consequence. The desktop auto uploader tool is now reserved only for pro users. So there's no easy way for people to upload batches of photos at once unless you're a pro member. So the author of this article on Wired says the move feels a bit like ransomware. Yahoo forcing people who've already bought into the idea of Flickr as a permanent backup to start paying for the privilege. And it kills the notion that Flickr can be a useful, simple, automatic way to keep your photos all backed up. I don't know. I'm sort of torn because it's not like Flickr was, you know, is it that crazy to think that people should spend $35 for 1,000 gigs of free storage plus the tools?
At one time, it was a pretty hearty community.
Yeah, it was a really good community of people, that photographers commenting and critiquing each other's work and stuff. I've grandfathered in on the Pro Unlimited, so I have unlimited storage there.
Mm-hmm.
So I can fill it up with all I want, but I don't know that I would leave it.
You're sort of committed if you've got how many gigs of photos up on there.
Well, I like the tools that they have for publishing to the blog and being able to, you know, embed them right into the WordPress site that I maintain, and I still like it. I like that I can go there, and because at least, and I'm sure other sites might offer this, but with Flickr, what I do is I go in and I upload photos. Like, I can put them into albums. I can tag them. So I can go and find photos from years ago and say, oh, I need a photo of Groovehouse at a Geek Gathering. I can find it. You know, it's all there. And then the cross-platform searching, being able to find photos in other people's streams. I still like it. But just...
Well, their suggestion, I guess if anybody's kind of on the fence or looking for alternatives, the one that's suggested at the end of the article is photos.google.com.
But I think photos.google.com, I think Google does not allow you to, is it Google that doesn't store the full high res? I mean, I think there's one site you have unlimited storage, but they down res the image.
You can store full res on Google, but they cap. So if you want more storage, you've got to pay for it. So that's where most of my photos are going, just automatically backed up. And I hit a certain point when we started sharing that I had to go get more space.
See, I'm on my phone. I have the Flickr app installed on the phone, and every photo I take with my phone is uploaded to an album in my Flickr and automatically hidden, so it doesn't share it publicly. So I have all of my phone photos are backed up automatically, and I like that.
It's the better way to do it. I'm still low-teching it. I'm just kind of going with what Google gives me on the phone.
Well, Facebook is doing it now too, so where if you have the Facebook app, your photos are being uploaded to Facebook and hidden by default.
Well, so if you're not careful, I've seen people, you know, they take one picture, it's uploaded four places, and you know, suddenly their data's gone. So I think some of the defaults are, I was doing that at one point because I got a Dropbox thing, and Dropbox wanted to upload my photos, and then I got like a Sony something or other with a camera, and then they wanted to upload my photos, and I installed something else, and they wanted the photos too, and suddenly it's, you know, they are everywhere.
Suddenly they were all suing each other on your behalf. Copyright violation.
Take down.
Barrett, you owe Sony. So that could be a good model. Build your service where they free upload and you're just supposed to be part of all of them, and then you go and harass the other services until they
What I don't like about Flickr though is, and I don't know if they have a downloader that would do this for you or not, but they don't save the original file names. They create really long string gibberish file names. So I can take a downloader and say, go download all my photos from the January Geek Gathering, and I get a whole bunch of weirdly named files. And I mean, thumbnails help. It tells me what they are, but I don't have any of my original file names. So any of the original file naming that I did.
And it doesn't keep the tags or any of that?
It does not keep the tags either. So yeah.
Oh, ouch. Well, some of how they can offer all the gigs of storage in that. I know I read, and this was years ago, so God knows what they're doing now. But you know, Facebook for like photo storage was doing these massive blocks of data, where it essentially turned huge numbers of pictures into what looked like one file to the file system of the server, but they knew how to get to the particular position of the data for each photo to get it out. Because obviously they wanted me to see, and they needed to manage insane numbers of photos. And so that probably is part of why they have the naming convention. So it's a unique idea.
And
that drop confirms for us that it's about 8:30.
Yeah,
exactly.
He wants to keep.
But it gets real next level, you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, for us, or even us kind of geeky folks.
You know, it's 8:30, right, Pete?
Ah, did I cut out?
Yes, you sure did. Yep. So we said next level. We heard that, but you know, there was a space before that that was silent. So, and he's gone again.
Yeah. Am I still gone?
Now you're back.
Okay. I keep, you know, the tough part is, you know, usually I hope that we get to something where there's a longer conversation on the other side, and then
right.
By 8:35, it seems to be fine, but.
I wish we knew what it was. If only we could somehow troubleshoot this problem and come up with a solution.
If only there was a show to call. Oh, wait, they don't do that.
They don't do that anymore.
Well, or sometime we just need to...
I don't even think Groovehouse would answer my call now. He's so hard-headed.
If we buttonholed Otis, I bet he knows what the job is that's running. He's probably the only one.
Okay, so I was mistaken. It was not Google that shook me down for more photo storage. It was Dropbox. And the weird thing about Dropbox, I think we shared it out to a few different people. And even though they were putting, I guess, uploading photos to mine, the overall shared counted against everybody. So it's like everybody was buying the same terabyte, or everyone, you know, counted that 1 terabyte of shared photos counted against everybody. If that makes any sense.
It doesn't.
It's like they're triple billing for the same, you know, 1 terabyte of storage is what they're doing.
But so you don't end up with 3 terabytes of storage?
Well, no, so let's just call it a gig. So like, let's say I had, you know, a gig of photos, which is probably a little bit more than that. So I paid to upgrade to be able to store a gig of photos. And again, that's not the number. But then as soon as they joined, even though they were my photos and I just wanted to share that with them, they got dinged for, hey, you've got to buy a gig of storage too.
To be able to see your
To be able
photos.
To see my photos, even though they're just shared with Dropbox. Yeah, that's what I said.
What?
Uh-huh.
Well, now what you need to do is you invite all your friends to lunch and tell them it's Dropbox rules. And what that means is when they sit down at the table with you, they have to pay for your lunch. You know, it's like pizza, you know. Well, yeah, we're going to divide it up, but it's Dropbox style, so you're going to have to pay for my pieces too.
Well, I think in that case, everybody pays
all
for the pizza and you only
get
one pizza.
Pays for...
Yeah, everyone pays for one pizza and they only give you one pizza. So you buy three, you get one.
Four people buy one pizza, but you collect all the money and you buy one pizza and give it to everyone to share. Some and profit. See, they finally figured out. They have solved the underpants gnome's riddle of how to make money on the internet.
1 gig, 2 gig, 3 gig, 1 gig.
So, I guess, shall we move on to the next...
Sure.
Segment. We could do that.
All right.
Bite of the apple.
Flicked was eating an apple earlier.
But so not loudly into the mic.
Well, he cored his apples, or apple. Now he didn't have it to crunch. We should change that to a live crunch. Flick is reaching into his bag with to get an apple. Let's see. I think we're going to get a live crunch here. Hang on a second. That didn't work.
Your mic is off. Take another bite.
That's annoying.
Okay, no more.
Well, nice. All
that
right.
Just didn't sound realistic. No, I'm kidding. If you go look for, like, sound of biting an apple, there are all kinds of sound files on the internet to be found, even when you're just looking royalty-free.
Bite of the apple, again and again.
And his, apple, right. And his apple's almost finished now.
Yeah. All right, bite of the
Here
apple.
Here we go. Well, so Apple rumors. You know, we're coming up next week on the – You know, it sounds like Apple's supposed to have a thing coming up. So no new rumors on that front. It's all still the same ones. But this one is an iPhone 7 rumor, which the iPhone 7, just to catch you up in case you're losing track, is what'll come out in September. But there are photos of some of the first cases prepared for Apple's next generation flagship smartphone. And the thing you can tell from that is there's a larger cutout for either a traditional camera and LED flash or possibly dual cameras, so it's a larger opening on the back. There are also two openings for stereo speakers in lieu of a 3.5-millimeter headphone jack. That's where that is on current iPhones. So basically, at the sort of bottom part of the case, instead of there being one speaker hole and one headphone hole, there's two speaker openings. The aftermarket case's form factor closely resembles an iPhone 6S overall, with cutouts for a possible all-in-one lightning connector, pill-shaped volume buttons, and side-facing power button in their traditional places. Early case leaks have been historically fairly accurate indicators of new iPhone designs, although there have been a few notable exceptions. The first cases for Apple's purported iPhone SE also surfaced last week, ahead of its expected March 21st launch. You know, that, like I mentioned on the case, multiple rumors have claimed the iPhone 7 will feature a dual lens camera system, which would be based on technology Apple acquired from Linux, L-I-N-X imaging, which could lead to brighter and clearer DSLR quality photos and give several other major advantages for the iPhone 7. Meanwhile, Barclays analysts believe the iPhone 7 will have dual speakers supplied by Cirrus Logic an Austin-based provider of analog and digital signal processing components for consumer electronics. Stereo speakers could be louder and route audio signals through two channels to simulate direction perception. So there's that. The no headphone thing could be, could be interesting, or maybe that'll be the big thing that everybody complains about for the next big iPhone. Because of course, all your existing headphones, unless they're Bluetooth, won't work without probably some adapter that probably costs about the same amount as getting new headphones. And then, in going even farther into the rumored future, Apple is rumored to be further expanding the iPhone's screen size past the current 5.5-inch iPhone 6S Plus, moving to 5.8 inches in a future device that could launch, quote, in 2018 or even possibly in 2017. That comes from a pre-publication report by Digitimes that was obtained by the Motley Fool. This stuff starts sounding like spy versus spy for Apple rumors. You know, it's like Digitimes had a pre-publication report that the Motley Fool obtained, and the white spy took it from the safe of the black spy, if you're a Mad Magazine reader. And then, I don't know, something else happened and one of them won. It states that the 5.8-inch iPhone will include an OLED display, in line with previous rumors of Apple adopting the technology around that time. According to the report, Samsung is to be the main source for the OLED panels, with LG and Japan Display, quote, joining in later. Recently, Samsung was reported to be on the verge of investing over $7 billion into supplying OLED displays for future iPhones, following rumors last year that 2018 would be the shift for Apple from LCD to OLED displays in its popular smartphone line. So based on Digitimes' estimate, the production of OLED displays could see significant output within the first year, though still only a fraction of the over 200 million iPhones Apple sold over the past year. So that may be part of what's holding it back, is for them to build enough to be able to really supply their line. So that's why the later updates. So the likelihood is that it could be the iPhone 7S, or more likely an iPhone 8 generation with an OLED display. So there's that. And finally, Apple, that there was, you know, Apple bought that company that was Liquid Metal, and there's a new patent that was granted to Apple by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office because it involves and got people's attention because it involves Liquid Metal, which is an amorphous alloy Apple's invested in an exclusive license for that has unique properties, but it's never really been exploited. Basically, they bought the company that makes Liquid Metal and used it to make a SIM card ejector. So it's just that little device, that little kind of fork-shaped thing that you can use to eject SIMs, that's Liquid Metal. But the new patent describes the new patent shows the substance as part of a future iOS device home button. In the patent, Apple describes the alloy as being used in a switch where pressure from a finger would temporarily deform the actuator, but using Liquid Metal would mean the button would always return to its normal shape, avoiding eventual permanent deformity. So it's like the metal would flex, but always come back to the way it's supposed to be shaped. No news on if it'll, you know, turn into Robert Patrick and chase down Arnold Schwarzenegger and try to kill him or anything. As with most Apple patents, this idea may never actually come to market due to various factors, and it is certainly not expected to appear on the next version or two of Apple's iPhone or iPad. One of the company's employees who has been deeply involved with Liquid Metal development recently announced he was leaving the company, which may or may not affect development plans for the technology, but obviously they're filing patents on it, so maybe it will happen. The Liquid Metal iPhone. So there's that. And that's all the Apple news that fits tonight.
No more Apple news.
At least not till next week, which hopefully next week will be there. I think Well, let's see. Do the dates? No, it may be too soon. I guess next week it'll still be prior to the Big Apple
announcement
thing. So we'll just have to settle for more rumors about. I don't know. At some point, you wonder how far into the future can the rumors go. It's like, you know, the Apple 12 is rumored to have, you know, hover capability because they're going to what, to 2019 or 2018 right now with rumors. So at least they're interesting enough to do that. There's a lot of technology companies that they don't know enough about what they're planning to do to have rumors about what happens in 2018. So, but
all right, have we got a TV on over there, Pete, or is it are you listening to the debates?
No, it's maybe bleeding from my chilling watching
the sound of his loins.
Watching watching YouTube. Several years later. Watching YouTube videos, I'm sure that's the yes. It's a whole different thing, you know. It's they don't miss TV at all, regular TV, but they do watch YouTube on the TV. So it's because they like the big screen. And it's in a lot of ways, some of these YouTube deals are similar to our show.
I've been, you know, recently, you know, because of the ability to watch YouTube on a television, I've been tapping into YouTube for content, like for researching travel or finding, you know, some people are, you know, producing some pretty informative stuff, and there's a lot of content there. I mean, a lot of really good content.
Now, have you been, I guess, I don't know what the word is, harassed into anteing up the $1 or $2 it takes a month to get the advertising to go away?
No.
Not. It seems like with almost everything I watch, though, there's, you know, it might not make me watch the entire 15 or 30 seconds. It'll give me a skip after 3 or 4, but the advertising's really been ramped up lately.
I can imagine. One of the things I noticed is Amazon Prime. You know, you pay for Amazon Prime and you get access to their streaming video, but they still have plenty of good video that you don't get for part of the Prime. You have to pay for it. And at least in my experience, what I've noticed most is the travel stuff, because all the dated, grainy video you want on traveling to wherever is free. But the stuff that's more well-produced or relevant to the modern age, you know, post-propeller flight only travel.
How to get around 1960s London doesn't do you much good these days, Jay. No.
So that's unfortunate. But YouTube, at least, you know, I've been able to go there. And, you know, when you're watching it on TV, how are your kids do it, Pete? I mean, do they browse on the television, or do they go to a computer and queue stuff up? The way I've found to do it is to queue it up on the computer. I'll go and create playlists and stuff, and then I'll go log into my app on the TV, and then I can find stuff more easily. Because I hate using the remote control to fake the keyboard and search.
No, that's painful.
Yeah.
They actually use the Wii U. It's got the thing on the Wii U, if you haven't seen one lately, it has a controller. One of the controllers that it comes with has a touch screen on it.
Really?
It's larger. It's about the size of a, it's like an Apple Newton size. So I guess it's like a 7-inch screen, and you call up the apps, and you could actually just watch on it. You can play Wii U games on the screen of this controller. They also use it for, Nintendo games use it like in multiplayer games. They'll have where one player is like, you know, kind of, well, one of them is a sort of a hide and seek game, and the player who's doing the seeking has the, looks at the screen on this controller so that they don't see where everybody is. So they use that to navigate, or some of them are where the players can't see things, but whoever's sort of in charge using it. But it's, you know, it's touchscreen, and it has the regular, you know, controls. It has the, you know, the gyro in it and all that, so you can move it, and it has all the buttons that their controllers do. But then they just launch the YouTube app, and then I think they type in searches. They have particular ones that people that they like to watch.
But they're using basically a keyboard, so they have that going for them.
Yeah, so it has an on-screen keyboard, so you can type it in quick. But these places, the YouTube, there's sort of a group that's all kind of aligned, and they put out stuff just pretty much every single day. There's new content from these people. It's pretty amazing how they keep churning it out. You know, a lot of them, it's 10 minutes a day or whatever, sometimes it's longer stuff, but, you know, at least 10, 20 minutes a day that shows up for most of these guys.
Those people have jobs.
Well, they have millions of followers. And so, you know, the sad part is that their income gets reported by like the gross amount that comes in for them, you know, where they have 4 million followers. But, you know, after Google takes, and basically through YouTube takes their cut and all that, it turns out to be a lot smaller. So there was an article about people who are only moderately YouTube famous. So they have like 400,000 followers, which is not a small thing, but that translates into like $10,000 or $15,000 a year in income from people watching the ads and stuff. And so they still have to work a day job. So they're famous enough that there's a lot of people who know who they are, but they're not famous enough that they're making the big money where they don't have to keep their day job. And so they get that, where one of them was like a waitress, and she said she can always tell when somebody, you know, when it's somebody who knows her from YouTube comes in and sits down and is wondering why she's their server.
Famous, but not that
famous. Kind of like us, because, yeah, we haven't yet gotten enough listeners to quit our day jobs. And even if we had millions, we couldn't. But anyway.
I'll quit this day job. But it's not the day. It's nighttime. Oh, well.
There you go.
I'm stuck.
So.
I'm not going anywhere. All right.
Well, has anybody looked at the big new game that's out, that's come out or is coming out, is The Division. I don't know if anybody's seen or heard on that one.
No, but I will say that I have kind of reached a, you know, I'm kind of done with Fallout 4 place, so I'm looking for something new.
You're all out of containers? Vaults. I don't know the nomenclature.
Well, containers, vaults. I can still find stuff, but I know that there's supposed to be an expansion pack coming out in the next few days or week or something like that. But so yeah. So what's The Division about?
The Division is
Tom Clancy game.
Yeah, Tom Clancy, The Division. It's I guess New York City after some kind of epidemic. And it's like you're the last line of defense. You're taking back Manhattan street by street or something. It's from Ubisoft. And I think it's made to be, it's kind of their future direction, where it's kind of an open world, but it's also made to where you're supposed to team up with other people online to do it. So it's got a bunch of, you know, so you're playing against other players more than playing like the kind of an offline mode.
Requires a subscription to an online service, or do you subscribe to the game?
Good question. I'm not sure. I just looked like the whole thing was that the big, you know, because that's the big new thing, is to make sure there's some kind of online element to it, and that they can get you to subscribe to for 40 or 50 bucks.
Says it was their best-selling game in the first 24 hours ever.
Sounded like the playing online stuff, because
you get owned by 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds like I do. One of the cool things I've heard is that Microsoft is going to try to merge. Maybe this is just to get me to upgrade from Windows 7 to Windows 10 on my home PC. But they're going to merge Xbox and Windows 10. So a game you buy for Xbox is playable on Windows 10, vice versa. That could be interesting. So that can maybe kind of bridge the gap between console gamers and PC gamers, but they're also saying, hey, we also want to treat the console much more like a PC and make it upgradable and do like small minor upgrades over time versus, you know, having to get a whole new console every 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, you wonder. Well, though, then you wonder though, are you going to run into where the where you, if you're playing mixed, where there's consoles and PCs, where you're trying to take your $300 console and you're going up against some guy who's got a, you know, $2,500 rig,
that, or just he, mouse.
Yeah,
I've read that they matched people up that were console gamers versus PC gamers, and they took people that were not very good PC gamers up against very skilled console gamers, and the PC gamers kicked the console gamers' ass.
Ah, so I have a feeling that means the hardware does make a difference.
Apparently,
there's maybe precision with mouse controls.
A lot more precision with the keyboard mouse, you know, sitting right there in front of your computer. I guess I don't know. I think that's true. I think that it would make a difference because
JG and I throw up the hands, but I'm the same way. I can keep about 8 or 9 buttons in mine, and after a certain point, it's like, okay. But whereas I've been typing for the better part of, you know, like 30 years, and you tell me what key I need to hit, I can find it without looking. So that's where I'm coming from. And a lot more precision with the mouse, too, than a joystick.
It sounds to me like the really old days. I remember one of the first network games I ever played was in the late 80s. And so that was sort of pre-Ethernet was really not happening yet then. And Apple stuff, there was Apple Talk, which had its own cabling. It had its own adapters and cabling. And there was a game called Maze War, which was this very simple maze. It was a very small maze. It had about, I don't know, maybe it had like kind of a 64 square grid to it. So it was like 8 segments across and 8 segments high. And you could shoot a missile. You were like, you looked like an 8-ball and you could shoot a missile. And it was at our business. I guess long story short, we upgraded the computers for the developers. And one of the sales guys wanted to play Maze Wars with us, so we put him on an old computer, and we could outrun his missile. When he'd shoot a missile at somebody, you could turn around, run away, and come up behind him and shoot him before he could.
Level ends in 30 seconds.
All right, well, like, that sound you're hearing, the music indicates that it's time for us to take a short break, take care of some station business, blow our noses, and all that good stuff, and we'll do that, and we'll come right back after those messages. You're listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groovehouse.
Be a benefit concert for the family of late KPFT DJ Bill Bates. 10 bands playing the show will honor the former host of longtime KPFT metal show Sweet Nightmares. Bands include Immortal Remains, Spectral Manifest, Blood of an Outlaw, Space Rhino, Serpientes de Fuego, and many more. The benefit will include a raffle and a silent auction. Funds raised will go to the family of Bill Bates to help in funeral expenses. This concert happens at Scout Bar, located at 18307 Egret Bay Boulevard. The date is March 20th from 1 p.m. until midnight. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
I don't know why nobody told you how to
learn how. out to help fight injustice at the Rothko Chapel with the symposium Confronting Inequality, Alternative Economies, Resilient Communities. The symposium will begin at 7 p.m. on Thursday, March 31st, with a keynote by Terry Tempest Williams, author, conservationist, and activist. Her writing on ecological consciousness and social change has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Orion Magazine, and numerous anthologies worldwide. The event will then continue with interactive panel discussions at 7 p.m. on Friday, April 1st, and at 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. on Saturday, April 2nd, and Sunday, April 3rd. The full schedule can be found at rothkochapel.org. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. We now return to Technology Bites.
The graphics on the Division look pretty outstanding, but it does not look like it's really designed for single player.
No.
So
it's a multiplayer.
You know, sure. I just,
you have friends and you get together and you guys gotta fight together.
Looking at a review, they talk about that there's sort of pretty standard RPG with a loot system on top of it, third-person shooter. But he says, then there's the Dark Zone. And this reviewer finds the Dark Zone is pretty cool. He says, I ventured into the Dark Zone on my second day with the Division. It's a blended PvP and PvE. I don't know what that means.
Player versus player, player versus everybody. Everything can kill you.
You can kill AI enemies for loot, but in order for that loot to be usable, you've got to call in a helicopter and extract it. While you're doing that, you've got a huge target on your back, and other players can kill you at any time to get your loot, even if they're part of your group. And he says it gives you that sense of apprehension from the recent spate of survival games and applies something of a AAA sheen on top, and it's pretty great. He basically wishes, ultimately, that this was the whole game. Because apparently, after doing that, he finds the rest of the kind of RPG stuff kind of a slog, where you just go, you know, you go mission to mission and try to build up your levels and your experience and so on.
Solo players in the Dark Zone and the beta quickly became the favored target of rogue agents.
Yeah, so let's say that's just like a grief fest is what that is. You just get, you know, someone bored on the weekend and they're just going to come down like grief. Now
I found a pistol. Gonna, yeah. Gas magic missile. Attack the darkness.
Now, if they could have bells in there and then get a Pink Floyd soundtrack, that would be cool.
Division, I want to Bell, find a game that lets you, take a squad into Second Life.
Is that still around?
Hey. Evidently, I actually asked.
We had Lawrence at the Geek Gathering. Mr. Is Full of Crap.
Yeah, so I actually asked him. I was like, "Are you still doing Second Life?" And he said, "Yeah." I'm like, "Is it still around?" He's like, "Well, maybe it's on its last leg." I'm like, "How many last legs has it had?" But he said it was still around.
Yeah. He still posts screen caps to his Flickr, so he's totally up to date. So I don't know. I don't know if the Division's going to be the game to replace it, to replace the Fallout 4 in my life.
Well, one thing that's sort of interesting is most of the games now that come out seem to come out for all platforms pretty much at the same time, as opposed to being like a tentpole, you know, franchise thing for just one. Because it looks like the Division's out for every platform you can that you really can seriously play on right now.
I think the publishers are, probably it's less important once a console's been out and established. But it seems like, you know, the titles that are matched to the consoles seem to be much more. That's much more of a launch thing. I think that the publishers can realize they can make a lot more money and sell a lot more games if they actually, you know, distribute it to all the different consoles and PC as well.
Well, and I'm guessing also with the kind of the sort of standardization, you know, kind of API type thing that they have to make so that you can network huge numbers of players, that in the end it makes them all kind of the same, you know, and I don't mean makes them all the same like each other, but that all the different platforms pretty much have to kind of accomplish the same thing. And so, it's just as well to have as many different people who can get in your online thing and participate as possible. Although I guess I haven't really looked. I'm assuming they all kind of play in the same pool, as opposed to that all the Xbox players are all in one.
I don't know. I think on some of the games that, and it's been a while since I fired up a console, but it seems to be that you play against mostly just players in the network. So, for instance, if you've got, and it's not so much because the game publisher's doing it, it's because the consoles are doing it. It's like if you play network games, most of the game hunting now is done through, Groovehouse, help me out. What's the Xbox thing that you guys
Xbox
pop
One?
Up? Yeah, but it's, what's it called, though? It's just kind of baked into the gaming system now, like when you can see who's on and...
Gamer tag,
yeah. So it's kind of baked into your gamer tag, so it's like a universal way of all the Xbox stuff. So I think most... I never see any Sony people in there. It's all other Xbox One people when I play Xbox
One. Because you have to... When you play Xbox Online, you have to join Xbox Live. It's, I don't think you can see...
Right.
You don't see players from other consoles.
No.
As far as I know.
I wonder how long that segregation's going to hold out. Because at some point it may get to where to really get the numbers you want. Because right now they basically sort of have to bet. You know, if you get on the wrong platform that doesn't have a lot of people doing the online, then they're big.
There's enough 12-year-olds to go around, I think.
Well, as a gamer, do you care? Like, I mean, I think as long as you've got critical mass for that platform, you're okay. Like me getting on an Xbox, unless I've got a great advantage over someone on a PlayStation, I don't want to play someone on a PlayStation. Actually, it's not that I don't want to. It's just that I don't really care, you know.
Right.
It doesn't matter who that is, as long as it's like a human intelligence, not an artificial one.
True. Could, you know, I just wonder though, you know, again, like for long term, although I guess their thing is they just like, you know, at some point they just sort of turn them off, you know, if the, or put out the next version of the game for people to,
Yeah. And that's the sad thing is it, a lot of this stuff, you know, when, and not to go way back, it kind of seems like the Reminiscence Show now, but you know, back in the day when you could run your own Quake servers and things like that, you know, you wouldn't really necessarily have to worry about these servers going away because you could host it yourself. You could do a LAN party. You know, you had the tools, you had the software, you had the hardware to do it. But now with a lot of the games that, you know, have the online experience, you know, very quickly these could become abandonware. And, you know, we kid about, like, you know, the game's not fun if it's only, you know, single player mode. But that's what we could be left with. And I'm assuming you can even get single player mode because it seems like so many of the games reach out to get updates or to check something or to make sure that you're okay to play that game. You know, who knows in 10 years? I don't know if you'll be able to throw a DVD in or some content, just be able to play it if that company's not around anymore.
Right.
Yeah. So someday that you know, it, just imagine the being the last person in Second Life or in one of these games. Well, especially I guess the looting thing. You know, you just pile up this huge pile of loot and call the helicopter, and nobody comes to try and take it from you.
Especially if the software has to call home to verify that you have a legal license to play it, and it's on their servers. Or like if you had a movie on some kind of medium, mm-hmm. and you had to hook the player into your phone. I mean, into your phone line, into your landline, and then it had to like, and you could pay rental fees instead of buying it outright. But every time you wanted to watch it, it had to go back to verify with the company that you did that.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. So I guess that's the other piece is the whole kind of, you know, if the whole key to the game, I mean, is the network side of it, then they've kind of got the built in, you know, they know who it's tied to your account and you can't share the discs and play at the same time and all that.
It's,
so
it's kind of the way they've, I think, combated a lot of the copy protection, you know, antics that were going on out there. So you couldn't just, you know, like break serial numbers, you know, like hack the software and pass it around. Now it literally checks in every time you want to get online. So it's very easy to police at that point.
It would be annoying though. Like if, you know, if they released it on several consoles and you couldn't do any cross console playing, you know, and you just happen to be on the console where there were 17 players and they were all like absurdist griefer players, you know, and meanwhile, like, you know, the other console has like 70,000 players, and it's like the best players in the world are all playing on that.
That's kind of what, and not so much the consoles, but like let's even look at like the PC platform, and you know, roll all the way back to like Worlds of Warcraft. There are different, I think they're called realms, and some realms are better than others. You've got a lot of them are geographically located because you want to be close to fast servers, so you wouldn't want to like be playing in an Asia Pacific realm that has Asia Pacific servers in the US. So generally, you know, you're grouped into there, and then there are different kinds of realms. Like Pete mentioned earlier, you could be player versus player, you could be PvE, different levels of that. And then there are, you know, there are servers that are known for very, very good guilds and very good players, and you want to try to get on those because a lot of it, there are now world events in games, and if, you know, a certain guild unlocks a world event, it's good for everybody on that world. But it gets to that point where, you know, certain realms will die, and they'll just be like a handful of people that were on there forever ago, and it's very sad and very lonely, and then they're the ones that you really want to get into.
I have a lot of Brazilian friends on Orkut.
And they shut that down too, didn't they?
I
think
believe
it got
they
shut down
just very recently. Yeah. They announced it was going to get shut down a couple years ago.
That's one thing Google's not shared.
Yeah, if you go to orkut.com, like, it takes you to Google.
Yeah, yeah,
Google's,
just
Google's
recently.
Not scared to kill stuff when
they're
dumb.
They killed Brazil. Where did, really, all my Brazilian friends.
Well, yeah, imagine with virtual reality, there's the other thing. So when imagine, you know, when you've got your virtual reality online world and it gets abandoned, so then you're totally virtually alone.
Who else is, I know we've kind of digressed from our show prep stuff, but who else is coming out with some VR headsets? Didn't someone else just announce one? I know Microsoft said they are. And then there was another company that seemed like more of a console gamer company, but they said they're coming out with a cheap headset too.
I remember seeing stuff around about it, but they didn't do anything real recent, so it didn't show up, in any of the news I was seeing. Here's VR headset release dates. So Tom's Guide has a VR headset mega guide.
So it's kind of aged to the point where there are enough to review and enough to, that's cool, actually.
So apparently, let's see. There's the Samsung Gear VR, Google Cardboard.
HTC is the one that I was thinking of. HTC is the big player because before it was kind of the Oculus Rift, but HTC, that's a big manufacturer of handsets and did, you know, a couple of Google's flagship phones. They're coming out with something. I don't know if it's called the Vive or the Viva, but it's V-I-V-E, and it's supposed to be kind of similar to the Oculus Rift.
Yeah, right now they're showing the Vive Pre, P-R-E. Pre-orders will begin on February 29th with an April 2016 ship date. The company has yet to announce pricing. At least this is on the Tom's Guide thing. There's PlayStation VR, originally called Project Morpheus. Razer. OSVR, open source virtual reality.
Samsung Gear has some coming out, already has it out. LG is doing it. They've got a 360 VR. So it looks like, you know, whereas 3D was the kind of thing 2 years ago, maybe this is the year for VR.
Could be, although, you know, remember a few years back when people were talking about how the Kinect was was making, you know, sort of full body video gaming a reality. It was time. And is that really, Jay has an Xbox One. Is that kind of stuff really a part of what you're doing with?
You don't turn on your Kinect, do you, at home? Or play any full body
video
games?
Are
you
connecting?
I do.
Do you? Do you cover up before you walk in front of the magical eyes?
No, he wears his robe. He wears his robe without the belt.
You enter my living room at your own risk.
He's got a flannel robe, but he lost the belt.
I can't remember. I bought one game that's it's an activity game, and you know, so you jumping and climbing and running around and trying to get some physical exercise out of the deal. But what I really like, and I can't remember the name of the game now. But they have you build your avatar. It scans you. And it really, you know, makes
is it kind of an ego hit?
It is kind of an ego hit. So I've got this great, you know, avatar of myself and an avatar of Cynthia, and we're, you know, in skin tight, you know, clothing, which is not unflattering, at least for the avatar. But it's cool the way that the software has this. It does it. It scans you. It figured out I had a beard. It figured out. It told me to take off my glasses, and you know, it did a really interesting job.
You know, Jaylee and I've been. We've seen a lot of the Scan Connect stuff where it's very cheap. You know, 3D scanning to you know convert ourselves into 3D images and stuff like that. So I don't think that stuff changed the world, but I do think it slowly started to move the way people like think about things. Now no one's super impressed by it because it's kind of become a part of not a part of our daily lives. It's kind of commonplace now. And I'd say VR headsets. These are really kind of like head wearable displays. They're not quite VR yet, but it's coming to the point where it's you've got options now, and it's getting kind of cheap.
Yeah, and it's going to be. I think one of the things that that affects some of this stuff is and why it doesn't advance as quickly as we might like is because of Moore's Law kind of slowing down, at least sort of lately. You know, talked about that last week with Intel. You know, they're not getting the double the power on a cheaper processor as close together as they used to. And so making these things really, really pop, the extra horsepower for low money is not coming like it used to. So, well, should we roll another segment?
We should.
Cool.
In the geek world, we hear about new gadgets and gizmos every day. But can they stand a dip in the snart tank?
So this one's kind of a repeat, or not well, it's one that we've talked about before, I think earlier. Or at least something like it.
Is it everything you do a repeat?
No, it's a peep.
It's a peep.
No, this one I know we've talked about similar things, and this one is apparently a shipping product, and is an improvement on one we talked about before, which is an e-ink iPhone case, and this one And by the way, I forgot to mention earlier, you know, if you go to geekradio.com, there's links to all the articles that we used as reference for tonight's show. So if you want more info or want to follow up on the links or whatever. But this one, it's called the Pop Slate, and it's where the back of your phone has an e-ink display that, you know, that has information that it can keep showing you without, you know, burning your phone battery, and has the kind of quick at a glance type info that you might ordinarily, you know, pull your phone out, have to turn it on and, you know, sign in and do all that stuff. Like a lot of first generation crowdsourced products, the original didn't quite live up to the promise. Although in this Wired article, they said that the Pop Slate 2 looks like a very promising course correction. They said the original Pop Slate, which materialized last spring, worked as advertised, but its limitations made it difficult as an everyday case. One of the things that they did is apparently it charged with a different cable than the phone that it was designed to fit, and at launch only displayed still images pushed from an app on the front of the phone. It eventually used IFTTT. To prompt screen updates without manual intervention, but even that required obviously a little bit more digital elbow grease and a little less functionality than you could justify with the added bulk and expense. The Pop Slate 2 doesn't just promise to address those issues. Apparently, it actively adds a bunch of new functions. They ditched the micro USB, so it's got the same cable as your phone. Because it's for Apple, it's for an iPhone. And the case itself has a backup battery that can add up to 9 hours of talk time or 4 hours of browsing to your phone. And it actually did that and got thinner than the original Pop Slate. The display itself has improved as well, still shatterproof. It's now 200 DPI versus the previous version's 115. And apparently it has a pleasant looking curve to it. The thing they said that's better than the hardware upgrades in Wired though, is the software. Rather than lean on static images and clumsy IFTTT integration, Pop Slate now pulls directly from a handful of useful apps to maintain a dynamic display. You have to download and use their app to customize the setup, but you have more options and you don't have to do as much fancy stuff. So There's a picture of it if you go to the page. They also are apparently in discussions with ebook providers. That you can read. You can't use Amazon's e-reading software, but you can do Project Gutenberg books on your e-ink display. So it's not cheap, I guess, would be the one thing I'd say is it's about $150 and is going to ship in July. But if, of course, if you spent the money on an iPhone 6S and 6S Plus and that, then maybe and you want that extra display thing, then it might be something that you might be interested in.
Does the case need a case?
It says it's, quote, shatterproof, so it's supposed to act as a case itself. But so if that's a little bit too rich for your blood, this one here, this is kind of cool. Google is discounting the Pixel C. So if you were in the market for an Android tablet, so now the Pixel C is $350, which gets it to be pretty competitive. And apparently, if you think about with the Android and developer preview, and split screen coming to Android, then the Pixel C could be more promising than ever. So they're offering, to get the lower price, it's a developer discount. So you have to, it doesn't make you prove that you're a developer. So you can just say, I'm a developer and I want a Google Pixel C for $350. It's a 32 gig tablet. It usually is paired with a keyboard, but obviously for the 350, you don't get the keyboard. And you have to buy that for another 150 if you want it. It's a 10.2 inch 2560 by 1800 LCD screen. It's got an all metal body and high res display. In the Ars Technica review of it back when it came out, it's only a few months. It's only been out for about 3 months. So getting it for $150 discount is pretty good. Apparently the problems ours found in their first reviews were bugs with keyboard pairing and touchscreen responsiveness, but those have been fixed. And, the issue of Android not being great for tablets, but it sounds like Android N also takes care of a bunch of those things. So there's that Google discount. It seemed like they were announcing a lot of stuff this week. And then the other one that people might be interested in is, I guess, is it Project Fi or Project Fi?
I think it's
Fi. Yeah. Google Fi,
Super Fi.
Wi-Fi.
Okay. Well, remember it was an invite-only thing before? Google's Project Fi cellular service is dropping the invite requirement. And to celebrate, the company just announced the deepest discount ever on the Nexus 5X. So you can do Google Fi and get the usually $350 Nexus 5X for just $200. That offer's valid from today until April 7th. So the nice part about this is, if the lower price makes you think of the, two-year contract pricing where you get the cheaper phone, Project Fi is a prepay service with no contracts. So you could cancel at any time. You just have to, the only fine print is you have to activate Google Fi service on the same account within 30 days of device shipment, so that you have to do at least 1 month, which, still is not a bad deal, and trying out Project Fi might be fun. If you don't remember what Google Fi or Project Fi is, it's Google's MVNO service that continually switches between Sprint and T-Mobile while only charging you for the exact amount of data you use down to the megabyte. So you pay ahead, but you only pay for what you actually use. And the only real downside is extremely limited device compatibility. That network switching feature means Fi only works on the Nexus 5X, 6, and 6P. Project Fi charges a $20 base fee for unlimited texting and calls, plus $10 per gigabyte of data. So that is a pretty inexpensive setup.
What I'm not clear on here, and I obviously haven't read the whole article, but on the pricing, they talk about for $10 a month, unlimited talk or text over Wi-Fi and cell, unlimited data over Wi-Fi. So what's the Wi-Fi? Where is that coming from?
Your house?
Yeah,
Starbucks,
your
I have
wherever.
No, but that no cell company I know of charges you for using
Right.
Wi-Fi data.
Exactly.
So that's a bit misleading unless they're providing Wi-Fi hotspots in some locations.
I think that's kind of the idea, is they're trying to blanket certain areas with that. But
yeah.
Your chances are, unless you're like, you know, like Austin or someplace like that right now, you're not going to be able to really take advantage.
Okay.
So, but, you know, for the over-the-air data, they're charging $10 per gig, which, you know, yeah, it's a month-to-month and you pay in advance versus the you know, kind of subscription price. But $20 for unlimited texting and calls, and then, you know, if you're using a lot of the data plans are, say, you know, 50 gigs, well, or 5 gigs of data a month, that's $70 a month, which I don't. Most plans aren't going to be that cheap.
So this is kind of interesting, not to cut Pete off, but do you remember when, you know, Google was driving around and they were scooping up, you know, locations of all the access points and what was open and what wasn't open and stuff like that? So very deep within the how the Wi-Fi works, it says that more or less, it's talking about your Fi phone, but your phone automatically connects to open Wi-Fi networks that we verified as fast and reliable. You go on the game, you'll stay connected in places where your cellular isn't as strong. This feature is known as Wi-Fi Assistant. So more or less, they've mapped out everything. I wonder, they didn't say knowing, did they? They just said fast and reliable, not implicit or knowingly sharing. So yeah, I wonder if that's not what's going on.
Ah, so maybe the idea is that you know, if you happen to be lucky where you're in a place, then it's going to be sparing about using the data that you have to pay for.
Yeah, and apparently it knows about all the open access points everywhere it goes. So,
wow, it seems like that would be a moving target, though, that would change a lot. But I guess if it can't, then it uses the cellular data.
Well, yeah, yeah.
And finally, this one's free, sort of. Free virtual fossils for everyone. There's a website called morphosource.org, which that's just kind of cool by itself. That's a good domain, Morphosource. Playing with fossils at morphosource.org, playing with fossils is not only allowed, it's encouraged. Basically, it's an online database to bunches of digital 3D scans of bones from both extinct and modern day creatures. Anyone with an internet connection is free to peruse the images, manipulate and rotate specimens, and even download the instructions to 3D print them. So if you want a, you know, like Australopithecus skull to print out and put on your coffee table for dinner, I don't know, or for just laughs, you can do that. So far, scientists have contributed images representing over 200 genera. Among the newest uploads are fossils of the recently discovered Homo naledi, the controversial species that may be at the base of the human genus. MorphoSource's collection is primate heavy, but users will also find scans of other mammals, reptiles, fish, and even insects. It's funded by Duke University and the National Science Foundation and offers several ways to search for specimens, such as by taxonomy, that's easy for me to say. But those unfamiliar with animals' Latin names may find the database difficult to navigate. Still, MorphoSource is a great resource for anyone who's always wanted to get their hands on some fossils. So if you didn't know what you were going to print out with your 3D printer, now you have something you can get. You know, you can do a I guess they must not have like full-size dinosaur scans yet, but I'm sure the day will come when that kind of stuff's available too. So that might be fun. Or if you've ever wanted to make your, like, you know, make a big giant, you know, early primate skull Halloween costume, you could scale it up so it fits over your head and have that for Halloween.
They should put out some kind of ability to 3D print them. Like, what do you call it when you put, what's the thing you put in the computer that tells a 3D printer how to print something?
It's like an STL file, just the file.
Yeah. The file.
Put in the file.
An STL file.
Print the file. That STL is just like one of the ones that a lot of the home kind of maker printers
use. They do give you the instructions on how to 3D print them. So
oh, they do.
Some, okay. Yeah. Yeah, so you can. So you have to bone up on your Latin, though. So if you, because if you want to find a particular animal that you want to get, but some of this stuff, you know, if you go to the site and look, I mean, it's got like the, you know, some of these fossils and stuff are. It shows that they've got some details where it's got the joints and all that kind of stuff. So you can do kind of the, you know, talon thing or some kind of animal arm or whatever. So. You know, just, oh, commercial use of morphosaurus media is strictly prohibited, so you can't go print skulls and sell them, I guess. Yeah, file formats include TIFF, DICOM, Stanford Ply, and STL. So, so free fossils. That's the best thing we can offer this week.
Free dead things. Old dead things.
Oh, well, now you can really jack with your friend. You can like suggest that you go out looking for fossils, and you can bury some very interesting ones that when they look it up, that it'll really look like something. Oh, we found Homo naledi here in you know, Bernie, Texas or whatever, in Big Bend Park. So that's all the try by or fry.
All for right. Tonight.
But, yeah, Lee fills a lot of time.
He fills a big gap. Big gap.
So, well, is there any interest amongst people thinking about sci-fi stuff? I guess what the biggest movie thing kind of coming is the Ghostbusters reboot.
Yeah. I don't know. And, you know, I feel like it's dangerous territory to not say good things about it because a lot of the criticism against it is that they've replaced the four Ghostbusters with, you know, as male characters with female characters. So there's a lot of, you know, consternation about that in the...
Most remakes aren't that good as a rule.
No,
and I think just because you flip a gender button, maybe I don't think it's just automatically going to make it good. You know, I think the movie could have all, it doesn't matter. And, you know,
they do have, you know, it is a good cast and it's people that at least so far have seemed to be,
I don't know the genre that they all come. Oh, hello.
See, they were hello. Even, there's a ghost.
The genre that the films that those actresses come from. I don't care for those films.
I'm not comedy? Even sure who's in it. I've just kind of seen like bits and pieces, and the way it was kind of.
I guess I should use a different word, but you know what I mean. There's those women are in a certain type of comedy movie that are very sophomoric.
Didn't like Bridesmaids? I thought that was pretty funny.
I don't care for those films. I don't think that they're.
Have we also set ourselves up? Because I was at that age when I first saw Ghostbusters, you know, a little bit older than Star Wars, but I'm wondering if it's not set up as an impossible task to be as good as, you know, Ghostbusters was when I first saw it. Because the second Ghostbusters 2 and Ghostbusters 3, meh, not that impressed by the next two.
The original Ghostbusters, I think, and maybe for this generation, the new Ghostbusters taps into those people that like those actresses and those films and all of that. And so this is a culmination. I mean, when the original Ghostbusters came out, it tapped into that whole history of those actors from Second City Television and from Saturday Night Live, which had a great impact on me. And so seeing those actors come into this and all the people that were involved in producing that movie, the new Ghostbusters looks like it's very much a product of its time.
It's being described as slapstick. So was the original Ghostbusters slapstick? Would you consider it as that? I mean, again, I saw it at an age where I had not yet become able to critically judge movies. I probably thought everything was awesome back then, but I liked it, you know. I don't know.
I don't think it was slapstick.
No, I don't think so. What kind of comedy?
It was kind of like...
It
was kind of like Stripes or... like
Animal House.
Bill Murray...
Yeah,
kind of comedies from that era, sort of.
Dogs and cats.
Yeah, sleeping it's not together. Clear. It's not really clear what the story is, apparently.
Trailer, they acknowledged that there were four Ghostbusters before them, didn't it? I mean, didn't?
Yeah, and I think there's cameos from a lot of the cast from the original one.
So it's like a continuation of the movie. It's not like a actual remake, from what I understand.
You know, presumably it's like later, and it it's been long enough that people have decided, you know, have like decided they don't believe in ghosts again, and so that it's like the.
Gotta call Ray Parker Jr.
Because that was, yeah. Well, that's what I was gonna say is I wonder who
Ray Parker the third.
Who they're going to get to rip off somebody else's song to make a new theme. Because, you know, the Ghostbusters song was determined to be a derivative work of Huey Lewis and the News, I Want a New Drug. And if you listen, it's one of those where I, you know, at the time it didn't stick out to me. But once you hear both of them, it's kind of obvious. The whole bass line is basically directly from that, from somebody else's song. Hmm. So,
huh.
But, you know, I guess ghosts around, it sounds like, I guess from what I'm seeing, apparently, as far as what we do know is Kristen Wiig plays Dr. Erin Gilbert, who is laughed out of her new college teaching job after a book she wrote about her scientific belief in ghosts comes to light. Then, of course, ghosts start wreaking havoc on the Big Apple, and Gilbert has to team up with her fellow Ghostbusters to fight them back, which that's, you know, sounds like the basic premise of the first one. But, it, you know, it sounds like there's a whole new script and a whole different, you know, a whole different approach. So, not sure.
So does a male ghost get busy with her at some point?
Good question.
That was one weird point in the original one where it almost seemed out of context with the rest of the movie.
So you haven't seen the trailer?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, nor have I.
Yeah, it was just, that was a weird point in the original movie where it was just kind of like going along and maybe a little like PG-13, you know, little risque jokes every once in a while. And all of a sudden there's just this one sequence that's like almost like spliced in the middle of these other things that, and it's like, whoa, what just happened?
We
slipped into this weird 30 seconds of, like, you know, softcore.
That was still,
ghost
that was the nod
for a
to,
second there.
Like all the Revenge of the Nerds, all the Porky's, all the 80s movies where that was just rife with that. And they just didn't know any better. It just spilled on over.
The real question will be whether, you know, how many Shubs and Zools will know what it was. Be like to be roasted in the depths of Slore.
Yeah, is there an equivalent of Rick Moranis in this?
It'll have to be a woman, and then the gatekeeper will have to be a male.
Hmm.
They have to flip all the roles.
We're being kind of insensitive because there's more than just, you know, two different kind of gender things that
were. Well, there were the dogs, so they'll have to be cats.
Yeah, I don't
what's
think
the, what's the gender
fine.
Flip equivalent of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man?
Hmm, what's the gender
flip? Stay Puft Marshmallow Woman?
Mrs. Butterworth?
Aunt Jemima? Mrs. Butterworth? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know.
Mrs. Michelin.
I don't know.
Well, apparently, I did read something on the original movie, the Stay Puft Marshmallow. That was a totally made up. That mm-hmm. was not a real
a real product,
or a real product, and yeah. they because there was something else they wanted and they wouldn't let them, and so they just made up this other sort of similar character, I guess.
Yeah, like a cross between it was the Pillsbury Doughboy marshmallow
plus
version
plus the Michelin Tire. Yeah, you wonder, was it the Pillsbury Doughboy, which I guess would have been funny, you know, for one joke where they shoot him in the tummy and he, you know, woohoo. There, that's even better.
Except like super low pitch rumbling bassy version of that.
Slow down.
We should remake this movie. We've got this.
Well, there's a in looking up just to see about getting information on the whole Ghostbusters thing. For sci-fi movies, there this year actually for 2016, there's a pretty good list of stuff. I found this at Scream Rant. There's a Keanu Reeves thing coming called Replicas, where he plays a synthetic biologist who's determined to bring his family back to life after they tragically die in a car accident. That sounds kind of creepy. There's one called The Circle, which is based on a novel of the same name written by David Eggers, follows a person who works at a mysterious and highly advanced tech company that aims to outfit everyone in the world with real-time cameras in the spirit of transparency. But of course, darker forces of Orwellian proportions are at work. And there's a remake of The Blob. It's like, wow, who said that we need yet another remake of The Blob? But
that's science history at this point. That's no longer science fiction.
Yeah, well, apparently Samuel L. Jackson is slated to star in the film, too. And he's at, there's Cell from the Stephen King novel, where people like get turned into some kind of zombies by their cell phones. Some weird cell.
Oh, that's already happening. That's already There are entire swaths of 12, 13, and 14-year-old girls.
Except I think
that have
these are like
prey.
These are ravenous zombie-like attackers, as opposed to the kind of like shuffling, slow-moving.
12 and 13-year-old girls can be mean. and vicious.
Assassin's Creed, apparently, a movie with that coming.
Now, are they going to be filming on locations? Because that movie, actually, they do a pretty good job of going in and getting, like, the game.
Well, you said the movie.
I thought Pete said they were making a movie of it.
Right, but you were talking about the game.
Yes, so in the game.
In the game.
They go and they do a fairly good job of recreating all these actual cities. And, you know, you can go to Rome and you can go to these things. So I'm wondering, are they going to be shooting on location and doing a lot of the cool stuff in the actual cities in the movie?
I would hope so. I mean, one of the things I really liked about Assassin's Creed was, you know, I remember playing the one that whichever version of the game it is, it's set in Italy.
That's the one I've gotten. That was fun because you've been there, you know.
I had been there, and then I went back, and it was like, oh wow, okay, this is kind of because they.
Somebody to jump off that bell tower.
They did a lot of I was just thought about scaling something or getting my parkour on. But yeah, so if the movie has that kind of really rich, deep, historical, cinematic stuff, that would be cool.
Now, someone has, speaking of YouTube, you know, Pete's kids might be in the next room watching it even as we speak, but someone went and reshot some first-person FPV view of, I guess, people recreating Assassin's Creed, like running around in these same kind of uniforms. I think maybe the same one, that same version you and I were looking at.
Yeah.
You know, with the full jackets and jumping off buildings, and it's kind of fun. You know, it's not as fluid as the video game, but it's in the spirit of.
It sounds like, well, if you're looking at the summary for the Assassin's Creed movie, it's going to Spain in the 1400s. So I guess doing something
different.
It's
going to be kind of hard to hold them to it on that one. You know, saying, well, that doesn't really look like what I know about Spain in the 1400s.
Yeah, they're also, you know, I mean... It's not Assassin's Creed has been out for a long time, and so there was the whole thing where in the first one they knew that the guy they had an ancestor that had been one of the assassins, kind of thing. It looks like the summary on this is that there's an that it's Michael Fassbender stars as Callum Lynch, an ordinary guy who's offered the chance of a lifetime to experience the life of his ancestors through a revolutionary technology that allows people to experience genetic experiences. But then, to his surprise, his ancestor belonged to a secret society called the Assassins in Spain during the 1400s. And so he's into that whole – so it's not – there was a little bit of sort of a dystopia thing in the at least in the first one, because that's the one I played the first one. I haven't played any of the other ones. But so they kind of changed it up a little. And then the last on their list of sort of most anticipated, the Star Trek Beyond, I guess, is coming. That's the third Star Trek since the reboot.
That's the Trek and the Furious.
Yeah, for according to the commercial, it was written by Simon Pegg, which doesn't really fit with the whole. What the tone of the trailer. Another one that's coming, I guess it must be coming in July, is Independence Day Resurgence, where the aliens come back.
And this time their computers don't accept floppies for Macintosh.
Quick, grab your Surface Book Pro.
I've heard at the very beginning they show where the aliens tried to come back earlier, but they were using like Windows and it. And even without anybody hacking them, they blue screened and crashed into Jupiter or something. No, but yeah, it's still got. Let's see, Will Smith isn't in it, but Bill Pullman and Jeff Goldblum are in it, and Liam Hemsworth is. You know, Thor is in it, so I think he's the hero. Their number one in this particular list is Star Wars, or is Rogue One. So that's supposed to be this year. Rogue One, basically the kind of a heist movie with the band of rebels who steal the Empire's Death Star plans. Basically, the thing that started right before, I guess, Episode 4, the first Star Wars thing. It's how they got those plans. So that one, if it's well made, that could be really cool.
The movie I'm interested in seeing is. Which I think it's already released, at least in limited release, but I think it was in England. It's called Lobster.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Is this like the tire movie? What was that one called?
Rubber. Yeah, so this is kind of like a, I guess, like near future alternate reality where something like if people haven't met somebody to marry, they go to this institution and
to a hotel,
they have 30 days to find their soulmate there, and if they don't, then they're turned into an animal and you get to pick which animal you get turned into.
This guy.
And then like some of them decide to like rebel and they like go out in the woods and they're like fighting against this societal requirement of
Logan's Run.
I don't think they have colored discs on their hands that fade, but anyway, it seems a little bit absurd, but it looked really interesting. The trailer looked really
interesting. I'll take that over what is now passed off as science fiction, which is really just an action movie in space, you know.
Yeah.
I'd rather have like a cool kind of think about it science fiction movie than, you know.
I've heard they're working on a spinoff of that movie that Flick was just talking about where they become ponies.
I think Jay was already in that one.
It's called Lack of Romance is Magic.
It's called We're All Ponies.
We're all bronies here.
You guys.
And so. I am your leader.
Well, I think maybe it's time to roll one more segment and then we can fill the rest of the time.
All right.
I don't know, randomly.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're going to see some serious
science. So on the list of things you don't want to hear is Chernobyl is apparently getting more radioactive, not less. Here we are, you know, basically like 40 years later, and... It's radiation levels. Apparently, Greenpeace did a study, and radiation levels have increased in parts of Ukraine that were contaminated by the 1986 nuclear plant explosion. Key isotopes like cesium-137 and strontium-90 are still lingering in the forests. And the thing is, you know, you got Russia and Ukraine sort of fighting, and Belarus is there. They're continuing to cut and restrict funding for testing. So, according to NBC, people are continuing to eat and drink foods with dangerously high radiation levels. There's an estimated 5 million people living in the affected area, burning radioactive wood to stay warm, drinking radioactive water, and eating produce from their radioactive gardens. The monetary compensation from the state just isn't enough, and they're too poor to do anything about it. So the 54-page report also examines Fukushima, which is also not doing so great. And its forests are also turning into, quote, storage for radioactive contamination, expected to be hazardous for decades and centuries to come. Just to put that bright spot on there. And then the final story is more pleasant. So after that radiation messes with your eyes and stuff, apparently there is a novel treatment for eye problems. You know, we keep hearing where they're going to use, you know, stem cells and like use that to repair stuff. And you never hear where they actually kind of get anywhere with it. But apparently researchers in Japan and Wales reported in March 9th in Nature that they have found that they found a way to take human cells, reprogram to become stealth stem cells, and they've been able to make corneas out of them. They coaxed stem cells in the eyes of a dozen babies born with cataracts to regrow clear lenses. So the you know, usually cataracts, the solution is they cut the lenses off. But this, they got them to grow new ones that were clear. So while both studies are technically proficient and provide new approaches to treating cataracts or corneal injuries, neither will soon be ready for widespread use in clinics, says Henry Claussen, an ophthalmologist at the University of California. The United States would require more extensive testing before human studies are approved. Both of the studies that have reported results on the stem cell stuff have used small numbers of animals. And the other thing is they don't know that it would work in adults yet. They haven't figured that one out, but it is promising in infants. In the first study, Koji Nishida of Osaka University in Japan and colleagues grew eye-like structures in lab dishes using reprogrammed human cells. The proto-eyes grew in a target pattern with each ring of the target containing cells that correspond to a different layer of the eye. Then they isolated cells that could grow into corneal epithelial cells, the outer skin of the eye. And when they transplanted that to the eyes of rabbits with cornea damage, the human cells repaired the wound. So that's kind of awesome. They hope to start clinical trials within 2 to 3 years to repair corneas damaged by injury or diseases. So, and then the second study, the researchers took a different approach to restoring the eye. Instead of transplanting stem cells, a stem cell biologist at the University of California, Kang Zhang, I'm sure I'm butchering his name, prodded the tissue to repair itself. The researchers took advantage of a complication of cataract surgery. Stem cells in the lens start to grow when the lens is injured by the surgery or other means, but pile up in disorderly pearls instead of making orderly clear crystals. So it fogs the eye. It can fog the vision again, and they have to remove them with laser surgery. But taking that bug, they turned it into a feature. By manipulating levels of proteins that control the growth of the stem cells, they regenerated clear lenses in rabbits and monkeys.
See, that stuff just waiting to go out of control, and then we're going to end up with
giant eyeballs.
Yeah, whatever that monster was in D&D, the old D&D, the like giant eyeball.
The Beholder.
Yeah.
The Beholder. Wow.
Wow. Plus 10 charisma to Jay for remembering that.
Ow. I feel, oh God, can we not publish this podcast? Yes, the Beholder.
See, I remember it, but I couldn't remember what it was called.
One of the most terrifying things, but it seemed like it should be relatively easy to kill. It's just that when you stabbed it with your sword or whatever, it was going to kind of gross you out.
Because it had those stem cells that would, you know.
Yeah, it could heal itself. The saving throw stem cells. Oh, man. Now, you know, I've been nerding Cynthia over the last few years, you know, exposing her to things like Doctor Who and the Star Wars canon and Star Trek and other things. And I think there's like the ultimate nerding thing I need to do, which is host a D&D game and have her play Dungeons.
What version?
I would like to, if I was going to do it, I'd like to do it from the original.
First edition?
First edition.
I never played first edition. I never played second edition.
But, you know, maybe second edition would have a little bit more. But just I don't know how far we get. I don't think she's going to stay up until, like, 4 o'clock in the morning drinking Mountain Dews.
Well, you think. But you never know.
But at least getting it through rolling up a character, you know, picking a
character. The most exciting part.
You're not going to bed till we finish this dungeon. Get back.
I guess magic missile.
Roll it. Roll the damn dice again.
But I need to recruit.
Nobody goes home.
What would be really cool is to recruit some of the old gang to play Dungeons and Dragons, the people I grew up with playing D&D, a handful of locals, and including one guy who's not so local anymore, Richard Garriott from Origin.
If you're going to play Dungeons and Dragons, that's who you need to get into your game.
I need to get, if I could get Cynthia playing Dungeons and Dragons with Richard Garriott, and then a little side quest to have play, you know, Ultima, that would get her cred up.
I've heard, though, that Richard Garriott now only plays in an actual dungeon that is built for the purpose.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah, because if she likes that, you could introduce her to Ultima or what Wizardry was on the Apple II. That was a dungeon-type game that actually had... it had where there, it drew a little kind of like line drawing. It was green screen. The computer was green screen, and it drew a little drawing of the corridors and stuff. You know, what you saw, like looking off into the perspective down the corridor, and drew the little creatures and stuff. I house sat for a neighbor who had an Apple II Plus and that game. And I went like 24 hours. I realized that I'd like stayed up all night and I hadn't eaten trying to do this game. And, that wore off. You know, then you go home and sleep and it was hard to go back and do it more, but, you can look up Wizardry. I'm sure there's stuff about it out there, but yeah, you can stay ahead of her. See, that way, you know, by the time she gets up to the 90s, you'll be, you know, have your VR stuff and you'll understand it and you can guide Cynthia all along.
VCR.
Beta.
And once this finishes rewinding, it'll be a magical experience. although is any videotape, those didn't last. I wonder how many VHSs or any of that is still usable even at all.
I brought a VHS player out for the 20th anniversary Geek Gathering, and I tested it. I had a VHS tape, and I popped it in, and it was a recording of like the X-Files from the 90s, and then I think it played. Was that show Dinosaur or something? Dinosaur?
Oh, with the
not the mama.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of, wow, one of the, those on it.
The Sinclair family? Or...
Yep. You are correct.
So, nothing going on techie this weekend. We got a Geek Gathering behind us.
Geek Gathering is immediately behind us, so we have to wait a little while.
I missed it, yeah.
Well, you had to run off.
I know. I still miss Geek Gathering, so they're fun.
You had to go off to the Jurassic World.
It very much felt like that. I got that feeling more than once. We went out into the jungle a couple of times on some ATVs, and you definitely get the idea that, you know, around any corner could be a T-Rex or
Velociraptor.
Exactly.
Or what was the?
I was trying to think of his name.
Indominus Rex or whatever from the latest movie.
Or Jurassic Jeff Goldblum.
With his shirt unbuttoned to his waist. But
hopefully everyone's staying dry out there. It's just been kind of a, not a rainy snow show, but it's been
yeah, I was
slow.
Tempted not to come in just because I was tired.
It's been raining pretty much the whole show.
That's kind of, I guess that sort of passed through, that wave sort of passed through here because it was... Ours was last night, and then it sprinkled off and on today in San Antonio, but it wasn't anything big.
All right, well, you've been listening to Technology Bites here on radio station KPFT Houston. If you've been listening live, otherwise you're listening on the podcast, what are you doing?
Holding my phone.
It looked like you're aiming the camera at me. Yeah. It's like, it looked like you're awkwardly, casually trying to like hold the phone at me. Stop it. Stop it.
He's doing it now.
Yes, he is. All right. Well, thanks for tuning in.
Is that an upskirt shot?
Hell.
Oh.
Look at this. All right. Well, we'll be back next week for more Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
Oh.
I'm Barrett.
I'm grossed out.
Hi.
This machine drives neocon, jingoistic, warmongering, theocratic, faux populist, anti-intellectual, drillaholic, social Darwinist, racist, sexist, isolationist, hardline, strip mine, teabag, Confederate flag, birthers, screaming from the room.
Roy Zimmerman brings the sting of satire to the struggle for peace and justice. He'll make you smile with funny songs about peace, hypocrisy, greedy corporations, and intolerance. The Houston Peace and Justice Center is bringing him to town Friday, March 11th, to a fundraiser for Peace Camp Houston at the Unitarian Fellowship, 1504 Wirt Road in Houston. The show starts at 7:30 p.m. An optional potluck dinner will be just before the show at 6:30 p.m. for anyone wanting to share food and drinks and company. For details and to get advanced discount tickets, go to the Houston Peace and Justice Center website at hpjc.org. This is KPFT Houston.
Support KPFT by donating your unwanted vehicle. No matter if it's a car, motorcycle, boat, or RV, when you make a donation, your vehicle is resold at an auto auction, and the proceeds help to support KPFT programming. To donate your vehicle to KPFT, call 1-855-KPFT-CAR. That's 1-855-573-8227. And your car doesn't always have to be running either, but it does have to have an engine and be towable. And you must be the legal title holder. There's no cost to you, and you help out the station you enjoy with your vehicle donation. Again, to donate your vehicle to KPFT, call 1-855-KPFT-CAR. That's 1-855-573-8227. Thanks for your support. This is KPFT Houston.